Hello, this time on Sit Rep.
I'm prepared to consider committing British forces on the ground, alongside others, if there is a lasting peace agreement. But there must be a US backstop.
The Prime Minister puts the idea of British troops in Ukraine into the chaotic diplomatic mix. Nothing is certain right now, including who might be prepared to stand alongside us. But planning for the possibility is underway. So how could it work? What would be required? And what happens if the idea comes to nothing and Ukraine is left to stand alone?
Sit-rep
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Well, if we've learnt anything this week, it is that there is a long way to go until any kind of deal is agreed that could lead to a ceasefire in Ukraine, let alone the end of the war. But at the same time, we need to be ready for whatever comes next, don't we, Mike?
Yes, we do. I think, you know, something that is clear now is that there is diplomatic time and there is Trump time. And Trump time is sort of three times the velocity of normal diplomatic time. And this man with a great sense of mission and a sort of childish vanity is driving events in a way that is very uncomfortable for everybody. And I think what the Prime Minister was indicating there, we've no idea how this might work. And I'm sure President Trump has got no real idea how this might work. But it's important in Trump time to indicate that we stand ready to help if help is required at the military level. And I think that was the message that the Prime Minister was trying to convey in Trump time.
And what we want to do today is to explore one potentially very consequential option for British forces, the possibility that they might be deployed to Ukraine as part of any deal. We're going to set aside the diplomatic uncertainty about this as an option because the point is it could happen. And the Defence Secretary, John Healey, made pretty clear this week that planning for that possibility is underway.
We need a security guarantee for Ukraine, in Ukraine, that is capable of delivering what President Trump has pledged and says he wants, which is a durable peace. That requires an end to the Russian attack and no repeat of that in the future. The European countries have to play a leading part in that guarantee. But require a backstop from the US, because in the end, it is only the US that can provide the deterrence to Putin that will prevent him attacking again. And the detail of that is being developed. Keir Starmer will discuss that with President Trump when they meet shortly. But the one thing I'm not going to do is discuss details of the work that we're doing, the discussions we're having with allies and with the US, because the one thing I don't want to do is make Putin any wiser.
Well, it's understandable that John Healey there doesn't want to go into the detail, but we do want to shed some light on some of the big picture questions about how international military force in Ukraine might be shaped and operate. And then the part the UK could play. With us to help explain is former Chief of the General Staff, General Lord Dannett. Lord Dannett, great to have you on Sit Rep. Thank you so much for your time. Okay, let's just talk, first of all, about the aims of a peacekeeping force versus a stabilisation or reassurance force. What's the difference? Can you explain that?
Well, there are a lot of differences. And I think if you use the term peacekeeping force, you're thinking in terms of a very benign situation whereby an international force is more in a sort of surveillance monitoring role. That's all well and good, provided the parties are willing participants in that. Of course, our most recent experience, well, it's not that recent, going back to UNPROFOR in Bosnia in sort of 92 to 95, theoretically it was a peacekeeping mission, but actually it was a peacekeeping mission where there was no peace to keep. And the local communities made it really quite difficult. But that transformed when the Dayton Peace Agreement was signed, and what became a what was a peacekeeping force became a peace implementation force under the NATO flag at that stage, with much stronger rules of engagement. But as interesting as that is, I don't think these are very good analogies for what might happen in Ukraine. I think picking up on what John Healy has just said, if the Americans don't provide a backstop, this is not going to happen. And I think we all just need to keep our eyes and ears open to the conversation that's going across the Atlantic at the present moment. I say again, if the Americans don't provide a backstop, it isn't going to happen. Then I think you've got to look to see what an international force might try and do. Bear in mind, it's about a 1,000-kilometer front line. Are we really saying we're going to put international troops along that front line to monitor a ceasefire, to separate the opposing factions? If we are serious about that, that will need a very large force. And undoubtedly, it would need the American backstop that's being talked about. American enablers would very much be part and parcel of that. It's also being suggested that that might not be the right approach, that there might be a rather more technical solution, monitoring the situation from space, if you like, or closer in using drones and other surveillance devices, and just having a surveillance and monitoring function, and maybe a reaction function. It's also been suggested that the international presence might be less about separating the forces, but on the Ukrainian side, reassuring the Ukrainian population, moving around in towns and villages and showing to them that the international community is still very much supporting them. Now, I've ifed and butted through all that, and I think what any listener will deduce is that we frankly just don't know. And at this range, I would say the likelihood of putting an international force on the ground is very low. I can't see Vladimir Putin ever accepting international troops anywhere near the Russian border or a Russian front line. And if it's just going to be a presence reassuring Ukrainian people, I'm not sure how much value or how much effect that would have, that actually would have. So it's very early days. And I'm sure that our government will think long and hard about what it is they're going to ask British soldiers to do, which other allies are going to be with us. And back to this issue, which I think is absolutely critical and fundamental, will the Americans be part of it? Will the Americans provide a backstop? Because as I've said twice already, if they're not there, then we shouldn't be there either.
Yeah, and I know it's all extremely hypothetical, but it is interesting to sort of talk about the mechanics about of how these things actually work. Mike, in terms of the rules of engagement, how do you define those? And how do you define the mission if it's, say, a peacekeeping versus a reassurance or stabilization kind of mission?
Well, as Lord Dannett said, it would all depend on what some sort of settlement looks like. And at the moment, there's no detail on that, mainly because I'm sure President Trump hasn't thought about it. And one of the things that that I think Keir Starmer will be trying to say to President Trump next week is, you know, look, Mr. President, if you can create a peace, we want to help that, help you to work it through. We want to help to make it stick. But you've got to give us some enablers, us the Europeans, to help make it stick in whatever way you define it, whether it's some sort of peacekeeping force, some international peacekeeping force with some European backup or a stabilization force, whatever it is, we don't know yet. But we are willing to play our part if you can do the enablers, because we want your plan to work, whatever it is. And the idea will be to get President Trump to focus on a bit of detail. I was listening to Kurt Volker this morning, who is a former American ambassador to NATO. And of course, he says Trump never does detail. I mean, he does these big visions. He has a vision of a great summit, which should all happen. But he has no idea how he's going to get there. He just throws that to his officials. So at some point, somebody, either in the administration or outside the administration, has got to try to make him focus on details for at least a few minutes. And I think that's what the Prime Minister will be trying to do, to say, you know, Mr. President, you need to think about the rules of engagement that you think will be feasible, that may come out of the peace deal that you are crafting, and we want to help make it work, but we need to know what you need. And I think that'll be the tone of the conversation.
Well, okay, so I could just say, I think Mike's making a very important point there. And I think there's a bit of parallel universe going on here. I think there are some very sensible and grown-up discussions going on between officials. on both on many sides, but including American officials. And those sort of reasonable discussions can start to make some progress. But then you throw in the leadership, and I'm particularly talking about Trump. And as Mike says, he doesn't do detail. He does the big, bold statements that they fly in the face of otherwise quite reasonable discussions that senior officials are having. And if they were left to their own devices, we could probably come up with something quite reasonable. But there is a danger that it'll get overturned by another burst on social media and another new idea that comes up. And I'm afraid on that basis, it's quite concerning. I'm sure our prime minister will do his best to persuade Donald Trump to think about these things in detail, think about the implications of it. But the track record, which we've seen growing through the presidential election campaign and in his first few weeks as president, is that we get major statements without any substantiation, almost on a daily basis. Like, just think back to that. In Gaza, we're going to create a Riviera. I mean, you know, you just sort of sit back and your eyes roll. Yeah.
Mike, just interested to know, though, about what Ukraine would see as the most useful international mission. Would it be stabilization? Would it be peacekeeping? Would it be reassurance?
Well, whatever it is, they will want some sense of guarantee that if they're going to give up 20% of their territory, that there is some viable stability after that. And again, I mean, what's been said by Marco Rubio, for instance, is that we are aiming to create a secure, sovereign Ukraine. Now, everything that Trump has said in the last week or so goes against that. It's exactly the opposite. He's undermining Ukraine's future and making it very easy for Putin to just keep on going and take the whole of Ukraine while the Americans stand back and the Europeans are incapable of doing anything about it. But the strategic aim, as far as we can discern one, is to create a stable, viable Ukraine with sovereign integrity. And, I mean, President Zelensky, I'm sure, will go along with any practical solution which makes that possible. So either, as it were, a stabilization force which is strong enough to give him some guarantee, or a reassurance force, which could be a series of if we had the courage to do it, ground troops inside Ukraine who are prepared to fight if necessary. That's a stretch in terms of political leadership in Europe. Or perhaps a little bit more practically, what the British and French are now talking about, which would be some sort of air policing zone based on the combined joint task force. And Britain and France are thinking about this, because the idea of an air policing zone is that if we're going to do this, let's do it in one of the areas where we're much stronger than the Russians. I mean, European air forces are three times bigger than the Russian air force. So why don't we think in terms of an air policing zone? It could be run either from northward or from Fort Mont-Valérien. I mean, both France and Britain could either could run it. That's a plausible thought. It's just about plausible. Whether that would reassure the Ukrainians enough, I don't know. And again, if we ran a CJTF based on air power, they would have to be prepared. They would have to have the rules of engagement to be prepared to attack, to fight, to defend Ukrainian airspace and ground targets, maybe, from Russian incursions or any form of instability. So any of these ideas we come up with raise the distinct prospect that European forces will end up fighting Russian forces at some point in the next couple of years, following some, you know, very poor peace deal.
Not done it.
And I don't want to extend or expand the conversation, but I think the sort of thing that Mike is talking about is eminently possible. But I think we have to also, at the same time, think beyond Ukraine, think beyond a ceasefire and at least a stopping of the war there, and say, where does that place us Europeans vis-a-vis Russia in the next 2 or 3 years? What will Russia do once the fighting, the bloodletting stops in Ukraine? Well, they undoubtedly will reconstitute and refurbish their forces. Anybody would do that. And you have to ask why. You have to also look at this from Putin's point of view. His strategic objective is not just to swallow up Ukraine. I mean, that's one of the things he wants to do. It's to create the greater Russia, to recreate the power, if you like, of the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact. Bear in mind, scrape him to the core, you've got an unreconstructed KGB colonel there. We know what his ambition is. So we've then got to say, well, look, if we put an awful lot of energy into some kind of stabilization effort, whether it's on the ground or in the air or whatever in Ukraine, are we absorbing resources that perhaps we should be diverting elsewhere to grow our deterrent capability to make sure that elsewhere along the long border between European countries and Russia, that we are strong enough to deter any further adventures? Obviously, I'm talking about Poland, I'm talking about the Baltic states. And it gets back to the whole wider issue, I'm afraid to say, of are we spending enough as a country on defence? Are other European countries spending enough on defence? And are we growing a military capability? Not that we want to fight a war, but that we can deter a war by making sure that Putin realises that any further ambitions, any further adventures will come unstuck.
And this brings me on to the point, Lord Dunnett, as into what factors will actually decide the size of any force that is used in Ukraine.
Well, again, it comes back to what type of operation are we going to countenance? And Mike has talked very eloquently, very sensibly about this could be done as an air policing operation. And in many ways, that's actually quite attractive. But if we were to be thinking about a ground force, boots on the ground, given the size of Ukraine, given the length of the confrontation line, this would require a large number of troops. I'm going to put a sort of rough figure that's being banded around, let's say 100,000. Well, let's say 8 to 10 European countries are willing to contribute to that force. So the UK might put 8 to 10,000 troops on the ground. Now, you know how we operate. We'll deploy a brigade or a large brigade group for 6 months. But then behind it, there will be probably three more. So if we put 10,000 on the ground, we're going to have another 30,000 behind it. Now, that's 40,000 involved in this operation of an army, regular army of around about 70,000. We could mobilize maybe a number of reservists. But what I'm really saying is, given everything else that the army is doing at the present moment, we just haven't got the troops. Actually, even worse, we haven't got the equipment. And I'm not being negative about it, but when we sent the force to Bosnia in the mid-90s, it was a very capable force based around infantry fighting vehicles, the Warrior and whatever. That's still a very good vehicle, but the MOD has not been able to find the money to refurbish our Warriors, so they're going out of service. So my worry is it's not just numbers, it's equipment. And I think on quite a scale, so that you quite quickly come to a deduction. Notwithstanding, we've seen lovely television clips over the last 2 or 3 days of soldiers from 1st Division and 7th Light Brigade exercising in Romania with great determination and great enthusiasm and great commitment. But that's a snapshot. What we're talking about is something of substance and size. And that's my worry, that we just haven't got it. And if we haven't got it, but think there is a need for it, my goodness, we've got to start growing it pretty blooming quickly.
And I guess there's also the question of the duration as well, isn't there? Mike, could it be done with fewer?
Not really. I think, as Lord Dunnett says, I mean, any figure you come up with, you've got to apply a multiple of about 3 in terms of the number of troops that will be committed to that operation. So if we were to put in, say, 2 brigades or, say, 10,000, you're talking about 30,000 troops being available from British forces, you know, so that there's a group that are in the operation, a group training to go in, and a group that's come out that's being rested and re-rolled or whatever it might be. So there's a multiple of 3. And then remember that if this is successful, say it could happen, say it is successful, then it will be there for 20 to 30 years. Yes. 20 to 30 years, not 2 or 3 years. So success means that you lose those troops to any other purpose for a couple of generations. So look at peacekeeping forces elsewhere in the world. Look at peacekeeping forces in Bosnia. I mean, that started in 1991. Look at peacekeeping forces in Cyprus. Look at peacekeeping forces in Korea. You know, you're talking about a couple of generations ahead in which those troops would be lost for any other purpose. And so, I mean, if we're talking about a ceasefire line, of Zelensky said 110,000 troops, that would mean that somewhere, some countries in the world between them would have to stump up a peacekeeping force of 330,000 odd troops. Or if we're talking about a reassurance force, and let's say, you know, 8 brigades of 5,000 each, you know, able to move to a trouble spot quickly with remote sensing, even that 40,000 troops in theatre at any given time. That's 120,000 troops that somebody's got to find, which will be there for a couple of generations. So, you know, remember when people talk very casually about this, that Ukraine is the biggest land area in Europe, save for Russia itself. And compared to Bosnia, it's very big. Compared to Gaza, which is tiny by comparison, I mean, this would be physically the biggest peacekeeping or stabilization operation in military history.
Mm. And Lord Dunnett, you mentioned earlier the deficiencies in our equipment and our kit. What would be needed? What is missing that is needed or would be needed? I suppose it depends exactly what the mission would be, of course, but it could you scope out the options?
Well, if we talking about the size of force that Michael has just been describing, there is a quantum issue as far as equipment is concerned. Now, I'm not suggesting necessarily we would be deploying main battle tanks, but given that we're actually only planning to refurbish slightly more than 100 Challenger 2s to Challenger 3s, you know, the quantum is not there. I've already said that the Warrior Infantry Fighting Vehicle, there are currently no plans to refurbish it, so we've gone for the wheeled Boxer alternative. Well, that's fine, but again, the quantum of the buy of that is relatively small, and actually I would question, over the difficult terrain anywhere near that front line, whether a wheeled vehicle is the right solution. We've had this discussion in the past. The Ministry of Defence, given its way, would have refurbished the Warrior and a tracked infantry fighting vehicle to have the same mobility characteristics as a main battle tank. A force would need to be protected from the air, so air defence artillery, that major issue. It would need to have field artillery, another major issue. Well, we know we gave all our AS-90 self-propelled guns to Ukraine earlier in the war. We are procuring rapidly an alternative system, but are we procuring enough of it? I think everything that you look at, you have to say, we need these equipments, but we need them in large quantities. Now, okay, there's a cost involved in that, but there's an opportunity as well, and I think government needs to see this, that if we were to get involved in a major operation like this, and if we did need much larger holdings of equipment and ammunition, identify the money, identify the manufacturers that could produce it, let the contracts, and then, in fact, we'll be playing a significant role in growing the economy. And if we don't do that domestically, we have no alternative but to buy it off the shelf, so we're actually doing something for the United States economy. So there are various dimensions that we can look at this from.
Yeah, Mike, what could non-NATO countries do? Could they play an effective part?
Well, I think that might be required, actually. I mean, if progress is made towards some sort of peace deal that requires some sort of monitoring force, then I think part of the compromise will be that it won't be entirely European troops. It certainly won't be troops within the NATO context, even though it might be member states of NATO acting independently. I mean, that's plausible, just about. But I think we would be talking about United Nations mandated troops from some of the other countries. So you might be talking about, Indonesian troops, Bangladeshis, Indian troops. The Uruguayans are very keen to offer peacekeeping troops because they get it keeps their armed forces in income. You know, they used to, I don't know what it is these days. It used to be $1,000 per man per day. And the Uruguayans were very active peacekeepers because it actually brought in some income. But you would look at a bulk of forces from some of the peacekeepers around the world. But again, whether they'd be willing to go into into an operation in which the peace was shaky would have to be looked at, which again comes back to the point Lord Dunnett made at the beginning, that without American enablers, without America backing this up, not many countries would be prepared to stand on some sort of peace line unless they felt that they would have, that America would have their back if the thing started to go wrong.
And I think there's another issue which we haven't touched on. What would be the command and control arrangements, and under what flag would this force operate? Okay, you could say NATO. Well, Putin won't allow a NATO-flagged force anywhere near the Russian border. It could be a European Union force. Well, that's a bit of a problem for the Brits because we're not part of the European Union, as far as I'm aware. Mike has talked about United Nations. Well, United Nations is an option. the track record of the United Nations in difficult peacekeeping operations is not great. So it's a question there that I haven't really got the answer to. It could be a coalition of the willing, but it would the coalition of the willing or coalitions of the willing invariably are under American leadership.
Would the JEF be an option, the Joint Expeditionary Force? But that is a coalition of like-minded but NATO countries, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I haven't got the answer to the question, but I know. But it is a question that will have to be grappled with, because what military history has shown us is the first thing you've got to sort out are your command and control arrangements. That is the trunk of the tree off which everything else hangs. Get that trunk wrong, and then the whole thing is very floppy in a prevailing wind.
Yeah, absolutely right. We always talk about peacekeeping forces as if it's to do with the individuals standing on the front line with the weapons and the vehicles and so on. But as Lord Dannett says, and he and I have had conversations about this before, the command and control and the clarity of the rules of engagement is absolutely fundamental. If that's there, then other things can happen. If it's not there, then it doesn't matter how good the troops on the ground are, it will become a mess.
Well, I just want to play a thought from General Lord Richards. Of course, Lord Dannett, your successor at the head of the army and later Chief of Defence Staff. The idea here, international boots on the ground in Ukraine, might not be the answer at all.
I think President Zelensky, who does chop and change a little bit on this, is probably on the money. He said, let us do it, make us invincible, if you like, in terms of our ability to defend whatever land they keep in this deal, roughly 80% of the country. And I think they will fight if required, and we should continue to channel our efforts through the Ukrainians. I don't see that another 50,000 or even 100,000 peacekeepers from the UK and other European NATO allies would be a great addition to their much more proven ability with our backing to do what is necessary.
Lord Dannett, is he on the right track?
Well, it's certainly a perfectly reasonable alternative track. And frankly, it might be, given the difficulties that we've been exposing in this theoretical conversation of the last 25 minutes, it may be that actually what David Richards is saying is the more pragmatic and practical outcome, that by a process, which I'm not quite sure how it would be managed, it might be decided that the fighting would stop and we would have to rely on the Russians and the Ukrainians abiding by the ceasefire arrangements. It comes back to what Mike Clark was saying a little earlier. It may be that the most effective way to at least exercise surveillance over that arrangement would be from the air, and that would obviate the need to put at risk a large number of ground troops. So I think there is a whole range of options. And going back to the clip you played at the start of this program, when John Healey was talking, he was saying perfectly reasonably, he didn't want to go into great detail at this stage because he didn't want to make Putin's dilemma any easier. If Vladimir Putin or one of his people listens to this conversation, they will have heard us going round all the difficulties and may well come to the conclusion that actually this is all extraordinarily difficult. And I'm not quite sure what deduction he would therefore draw from that. But I don't think it's in anybody's interest for this war to go on in the manner that it has been going on for the last 3 years indefinitely. The number of casualties that the Russians have taken over the 3 years is getting towards a million. That's going to have an effect on the Russian population. The economic sanctions are having increasing effect on the Russian economy. I don't think Putin can really go on at the level that he is. So a ceasefire is going to happen at some point because both sides want it. But the reality is where we are currently, and the Americans have already said it, Russia is going to stay in control of 20% of eastern Ukraine, and the opportunity for Ukraine to join NATO isn't there for at least a generation. So it's quite a bleak prospect at the present moment.
Mike, we talked before about the US backstop and their security guarantee. If Washington did agree, what would that require for them to do?
I mean, a US backstop would mean, I think, two sorts of things. One would be enablers to any force, which is the air transport, heavy lift, and ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, a lot of information that only the Americans can gather, which would be critical, of course, to any force that were found itself somehow involved in this process. So that's one area. But then the other area is some sense that the US would be prepared to take on the preservation of its peace deal if it began to slip away. And that might be plausible, just about, within the four-year term of President Trump. I mean, if he rushes towards a peace deal in the next 3 or 4 months and it collapses completely during his presidency, it's not going to look very good. And it certainly won't win him the Nobel Peace Prize, which he covets. So there is a sense, maybe, that there will be a sort of a commitment from the White House that we must make this work, and if 2 years down the line it begins to go wrong. And I think, you know, that may be something to hope for, because the sort of peace deal that they look as if they're moving to will be a very bad deal indeed and extremely unstable.
And Mike, what is the size of the US military presence at the moment that's in Europe, and would that be enough?
In Europe, well, it's about 80 to 85,000 troops. But remember, Joe Biden sent another 20,000 troops when the invasion started in 2022. So, I mean, naturally, it might go down to about 50, 40,000. Interestingly, Putin looks as if he wants lots of sweeteners. In addition to being able to keep his conquest, he wants lots of sweeteners in sanctions relief. And one of the sweeteners, one suspects, will be to withdraw the 4,500 US troops who are in Poland and the Baltic states, where Joe Biden sent them. And that would be a very, very dangerous signal, because if there were no American troops in the north, then post a settlement, the Russians would be very tempted to take on European troops. If they don't have to take on American troops in Europe, they'd be very tempted to take on European-only troops, because they believe that Article 5, or they're entitled to believe that Article 5 no longer operates. Sergei Kalaganov, a presidential advisor, has been saying for years, Article 5 doesn't exist. If we press it, we'll find it isn't there. And if American troops were withdrawn from Poland and the Baltic states, there's only 4,500 of them, if they were, then the Russians might be very tempted to press Article 5 to see if it's there or not. And the chances are, after this week, that it won't be.
And just finally, a thought from you, Lord Dannett. We heard John Healey at the start indicating there are serious conversations going on at the Ministry of Defence right now. If you were back in your old job right now and part of those conversations, what would you be saying?
I think I would be pointing out the realities and the difficulties of this potential operation. I would be pretty backward-leaning as far as it was concerned, because for all the reasons that we've been exploring over the last half an hour, and Mike put it very eloquently, once we deploy a sizable or large contingent to a ground operation, we have to think of it in 3 or 4 times the size, and we have to think of it going on for a very long time. We mentioned just briefly in passing Korea. I think there are many parallels between the Ukraine situation and the Korea situation. The Korean War stopped in 1953. There has been no peace agreement. I can see this war stopping and there being no peace agreement. Yet there are 25,000 American troops on the Korean Peninsula today still. So I think extreme caution, exploring every other option, is probably what I would be encouraging the government to do. And I don't think they need too much encouragement to take that kind of view, despite the heroism, if you like, of Keir Starmer saying at the beginning of the week, he's ready and willing to deploy British troops. He might be willing, but we're not ready.
Lord Dannett, on that note, we shall leave it for this time. Thank you so much for your contribution today. That is all for now. Professor Mike Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.